Hello, everyone. Sorry for an interruption. I'm Christina, the producer of Career Blast and a Half, a no BS career podcast similar to Alan's, and a podcast very similar to another key aspect. They are inclusive in having autistic voices speak up about what they love. Personally, I prefer staying on the producing side than on the mic, but I want to support Alan's guest for today's episode, so I'm stepping out of my comfort zone. His name is Lee, and he's autistic and proud, like me. In this episode, you will hear an autistic behavior known as info dumping. In simple terms, it's when a person with autism, ADHD, or other neurodivergent condition is really excited about a subject and they will go in depth about it when asked. The fun part is internally knowing when to stop, which creates in-depth autobiographical gems like this one. I encourage Alan to leave this interview unedited, unscripted, and raw to provide you, the awesome listeners you are, some insight about Lee's mind by going through his history, as well as educate on what it's truly like to listen to a voice that is otherwise muted or edited to sound neurotypical or normal, like I'm assuming most of you are. So please, enjoy the episode with an open ear, and check out Career Blast and a Half if you want more no BS career tips and stories like this one. Take it away, Alan.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Sick Career Podcast, although we are changing our name to the Own Your Career Podcast. That's coming soon. We're in the midst of a change, but regardless of that, I am really excited to have on our podcast today, Lee McKeeman. Lee, like most of our guests, I have met on LinkedIn. I've seen lots of his amazing comments. He's actually more known, at least in my book. I've been more, not that I've not been impressed with his initial posts when he does initial posts, but I find his comments on other people's posts to be extremely thorough, extremely deep, extremely thought-provoking. And I just always appreciate his perspective. Lee has some really great background working. He's currently at Google as a SWE, software engineer, for those of you that do not know those acronyms at home. He also worked at Meta, worked at Amazon, worked at Blackbaud, worked at lots of different places as an engineer. I will hand it over to Lee to tell us and the Sick Career Podcast audience a little bit more. Lee, tell us about yourself, please.
Sure, absolutely. Super excited to be here and appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, currently, about myself, I'm four tech, maybe a little bit older. I'm about 41. I have worked as a people manager, which often happens mid to late career for a lot of engineers, but I have moved back into a software engineering role. I still consider it a sort of leadership role. I'm a staff engineer here at Google. But yeah, I have a whole slew of children, five total, yours, mine, and ours with my wife, 13 down to four-year-old twins with a 9 and 10-year-old in the middle. So we navigate that, especially my work from my home now, completely remotely. I certainly visit my team now and again out in California, but especially when the kids are off school, but I'm still at work, the lock on the door has to get used and to keep them out. But yeah, otherwise, I live in the Dallas area. I have left once to go up to Seattle when I joined Amazon. We'll get into that in a little while, but that did not work for me. So otherwise, I've been here and have been super privileged to be able to join some of these companies remotely now. The pandemic was obviously very difficult for everyone, and I did happen to get this benefit of companies being a little bit more open to remote. That pendulum is swinging a little bit in the opposite direction in a lot of cases, which is a little harrowing. I had a lot of doors open, and some that may have been open during the pandemic, I may not be able to join remotely now, which was okay. I'm very happy with my job as it is, but just an interesting observation. Yeah, otherwise, in terms of what I'm passionate about, as you mentioned, where we met was on LinkedIn. I'm super passionate about sharing knowledge about career development and our industry through a few different lenses. One from someone who's done it for a long time and who's made the shift to management and back, but two from a sort of neurodifferent perspective of being an autistic person, ADHD, anxiety, depression, some of these things lots of people have. Some of them don't know it. Some of them embrace it. It's very different. But talking about that for me, even if I can't say this is how you're going to do it because everyone's very different, talking about it, I think, takes away some of the shame about it potentially, or some of the identification that people are like, you know what, I just don't see people like me succeeding. Maybe this isn't the job for me. I will say, like, I've had struggles in my career and it's not perfect, but I've reached a level that a lot of people strive towards. And I feel really grateful for that, but do want to model that people with neurodifferences can achieve things still. And it's not just, I haven't seen anyone like that. And again, when it's someone's race or another disability that might be more physically obvious, people might see that, oh, hey, this person who was high up in the company is in a wheelchair. This is a Black female that's managed to get to a really high position. For neurodifferences, you don't always see that, and people don't always talk about it. That's something that's really important to me as well. So then I'll talk a little bit about some of my career journey, and then we can dig into some details that you think will be interesting for some of the listeners. But in general terms, I have worked as an engineer for most of my career. I consider that post-college. I don't think college is a necessary thing to be a software engineer, but it certainly was treated that way at the beginning of the 2000s when I was entering the job market. What you were supposed to do was go to college and then you could get a quote unquote good job. I definitely think that there's a pushback. I think that notion is certainly classist and racist and a lot of other things, that university education is not, I will say, not very democratic. It's not very accessible to a lot of people. And again, I don't think it's strictly necessary. I got a CS degree. It did not prepare me to do this job. I learned things that I find useful, but I certainly didn't learn to code well. Doing a project for a couple of weeks, turning it in and never looking at it again is very different than writing maintainable production software. And I know some programs might cover more detail in software engineering now than my program might have. But in any event, I graduated from the University of Texas in 2000. I started working at a company down in Austin where the school was. It was a sort of small healthcare informatics company building software to use in clinical laboratories and hospitals and inpatient settings. I worked on a system that most people would not enjoy very much. It was a laboratory system that was written starting in the early 80s using Fortran 77. It had gotten integrated with some C, but still most of the system was written in Fortran. That's not a thing most people learn. It's gotten some popularity with highly parallel computing because there's some really good libraries and really good support for Fortran and compilers to use some of these parallelization primitives. But in general terms, most of the population now isn't. People are writing Python or Java or Kotlin or C Sharp or whatever the popular languages are that have a lot of niceties. And Fortran has evolved as a language, but is not very popular. In any event, did that for quite a while, about 7 years, worked my way up from a software analyst, as that's the role I was hired as. What that meant was there's a production problem, go try to fix it. If you can't, maybe ask the engineers, but it's up to you. Go fix the broken things, which I really appreciate as a stepping stone. A lot of people do go right into an engineering role and are building new software and occasionally maybe adding to old software, but not in a support engineer role, or some SREs are in that role. But I think it was very different to have to, everything I was looking at was a bug in an existing system, and having that experience and growing through that and then becoming an engineer, I think was really helpful for me. And I really appreciate that opportunity, even though at the time it didn't seem glamorous. And identifying customer issues and reproducing quote unquote issues is really useful and really helpful in my career. That company was acquired. It was maybe 100 people when I started, even though it had been around for 30 years, it was still fairly small, not a ton of customers, but we did some really good things and got some certifications that were important to meaningful use from the federal government, which was really important for small hospitals to get funding to upgrade their systems. And not a lot of people were getting that done in the first year or two. So that made us attractive for acquisition, and that happened. And then things got a lot less fun and a lot less interesting. We felt, oh, the acquiring company still wants us to pursue some of these goals. We're going to...
Which company was this at? Was this at NextGen?
So NextGen was the company that acquired it. At the time, they were part of a company called QSI that was like a dental company, but they had purchased this healthcare company, and that's what really exploded and where they were making most of their money. And the original dental business has now been spun off and isn't even part of NextGen anymore. But yeah, NextGen acquired the company, came in and said, hey, over the next 18 months or 2 years or something, here's the things we want to see happen. We will pay more money. It's an earnout situation if y'all can manage that. And we were like, okay, let's do it. We're going to build this pharmacy system that's on our list. We're going to get these other certifications go. And then after, I don't know, 6 months, they were like, maybe those earnout goals weren't the best. We're going to cut that process short, pay it 70% or 75% or whatever, and really want to focus on different goals. We didn't pick the right things. And that was disappointing. Like, we wanted to do some of these things. We were passionate about them. And as it turned out, we were purchased. This company was a lot more about buying than building at that point. So buying a pharmacy system felt a lot safer and more familiar to them than having us build something from whole cloth, even though we had a lot of experience with it and integrated with those systems. And I understand it from a business perspective, but it was a bummer from an engineering perspective of, we're going to build a cool new thing. And it's, no, you're not. You're going to do integration work maybe forever. Like, that's what the primary job is going to be now. So there was some fun things with integration. We were running on Postgres on our clinical system. NextGen as a whole was using Microsoft SQL. They wanted our product to run against Microsoft SQL. That wasn't an easy task, but it was an interesting and exciting one. But once some of the stuff like that was done, it turned into a little bit of a turn of the crank. So that's when I started looking for a new role. I pretty quickly joined a company called Conveo, and Conveo built software for nonprofits. It was a publicly traded for-profit company, but the software that they made, nonprofits used for contact management, mailing campaigns, online fundraising, things like that. The thing that people are most familiar with are like the Susan Komen Race for the Cure, and having a team that's all running and being able to fundraise for your team, like that TeamRaiser product this company I worked for, Conveo, created. Worked there for 4 or 5 months. And then they announced that they were being acquired by the only other really big company that did this. It seemed like a niche space. It was publicly traded. It seemed pretty safe. And then talk of the acquisition happened, and I saw similar things happening. I've now seen that the original Conveo products have all been sunsetted. So being an expert on those wouldn't have been that helpful. I certainly could have learned new things, but it coincided. I wasn't looking yet. I was just a little nervous with the acquisition, but a recruiter reached out. It was an outside recruiter, not an internal recruiter from Amazon, but said, hey, do you want to come work at Amazon? And I was like, I can't do that, but cool. I don't have anything to lose. I don't have anything else going on. Sure. Like, I'll go and do this interview. And it turned out that I was in this imposter syndrome, I can't, underselling myself place, and actually did really well in those interviews, which was a pleasant surprise. But what came with that, as I alluded to earlier, was a move up to Seattle. Remote wasn't really a thing. This was back in 2012. So within a month, got my two-year-old and my wife at the time, and we moved to Seattle. And that was very difficult, it turns out. Doing the job was actually the easiest part, integrating socially into a different place, adjusting to a climate that is very different from Texas. Having it be dark at 4:30 p.m. in the winter it gets dark early here, but not 4:30 early. I would get to work and it was night. It's not, oh, it's sunrise. No, like, it's night. I would leave work, it's night. If you go out in the middle of the day, it's just rainy. So yeah. It was a little bit rough for a native Texan that was used to 300 days of sun versus 100 days of sun. Anyway, that job changed a lot quickly. I joined the streaming video platform. They call it Prime Video now. It's been called a dozen different things. It was Unbox, then Amazon Instant Video, then Prime Instant Video, now I think just Prime Video, but they didn't have mobile clients and it was a big gap. So I joined to help build the iOS client. I worked on that through the release. We, you know, did the overnight command center thing and got lots of people using it. That was cool. And then they said they were moving iOS development to London because They needed the teams that were local to be focused on Amazon first-party devices. And for us, that meant the Fire Phone. It sounded exciting when they recruited us to do that and made us sign away our souls in the paperwork to not disclose anything about the project. It's going to be 3D. That was all interesting.
Did you have to go through a different sort of interview process or signing different paperwork to be on this top secret project?
It was signing different paperwork. It wasn't an interview process. It essentially was like, you have to decide if you want to go to London and move there and continue to work on iOS or stay here in Seattle and work on something we've determined to be a higher priority. If you want to do that, we can't tell you what it is, but you're going to go into a room and a lawyer will present you with a lot of paperwork and you'll sign it and then be read in on the project is what they said, or disclosed on the project. And so that was the Fire Phone, but that came with a lot of disclosures on the Fire TV eventually and future tablets that Amazon was putting out, the Echo Show, because that has video on it. There was a world of secret projects was opened up to us once that happened.
So typically as part of a company, you have to sign an NDA. So this was like a super tough NDA or something, like super top secret one?
Bonus NDA. And it was also expressing like, what do you do with prototype devices? If you're at an airport and someone needs to look in the non-disclosure case, you have to ask for a private screening in a private room so it's not brought out in front of the public, and just a lot of extras that aren't considered as part of the sort of general thing, and a lot of details about need to know now, things that other people in the company don't, and you can't tell them. You're going to use source control that is inaccessible to other engineers, and how do you deal with that? It and a lot of details about, hey, we can't talk about competing with particular people. This isn't a beat Apple thing. We need to make the best phone we can make, not defeat the iPhone and things like that. It was exciting, but that product, I don't know how many listeners were tuned in that 2014, 2015 time span when Amazon put out the Fire Phone, but it turned out that product was not well received or well loved by the consumer audience it was aimed at. Ultimately, Amazon had been making very low cost tablets based on Android open source project, AOSP, that they called Fire OS, that they added Amazon stuff to. That was what people were expecting from hardware from Amazon. Does its job competently, and it's very inexpensive. And this was a premium device that had some cool features, being able to point a camera at things. And now it's like commonplace that you point your camera at things and it's recognizing the objects. And that's not new. But at the time, this Firefly feature that would pick something out and then tell you, oh, that's this product, you need to buy more of that or whatever, that was novel. So anyway, it was frustrating to work on a product for a pretty long time, pretty diligently, and then just the product itself doesn't take off. So you having a world-class video experience on this device that no one is buying or using is a little frustrating. And it teaches you something, right? Like, having Jeff Bezos say, we spent billions of dollars on this and we should take those kinds of risks, and they don't all pay off. Some risks like AWS paid off enormously. Some risks like the Fire Phone, we spent a few billion dollars on that and it was an abject failure from a product perspective. And we learned, like, we learned a lot of things. We built a lot of software components that were used elsewhere. From our side on the video, having a different platform to target and share the application code was actually a really useful thing to have done, to then be able to target third-party Android and the Fire TV device, which was way more successful and popular. So it wasn't all lost effort, but it was a lot of money spent that wasn't earned back directly. But embracing that you can work hard on something and do your best, and it can fail, and you did not fail, and you can learn, and the company should take risks, was like a really poignant lesson that I wasn't expecting to learn from that. Yeah.
So you were at Amazon for almost 9 years.
That's true. Yeah.
I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile, assuming that is accurate, which I think it probably is. Yeah. Then you went to Meta, and it looks like it was, like, you left Amazon in February of 2021, joined Meta in March 2021. So I'm guessing Did they come to you? Did you go to Meta? How did that change happen?
Yeah, I did a bunch of different jobs while I was at Amazon, moved around. Some were in video, some were in other departments. I moved into a management role and then was doing that for a while, managing engineers. And I wasn't loving that as much. Like some of the things I really did, helping people advance their careers and writing their promo documents and getting them to the next level, like that was really rewarding. There were other things that were not, defending against what I considered self-inflicted wounds that were coming down. Like that was hard to see decisions being made and trying to fight against that and protect my own team from it. It was work I was willing to do, but it was really difficult and it was getting a little trying, and I wasn't writing code, or I was, but it was only in code review. And no, I wasn't supposed to really be doing that as a manager. Like I should let the engineers own that. And that was a hard thing for me to let go of. And I realized, like, I do want to lead. I do want to help people advance their careers. I don't know if doing it as their direct manager and being further away from the code and the designs is the right way to do it. So I had been promoted as a manager, which was nice. I liked that. I was at the level that was for a manager, the same as a senior engineer at Amazon, level 6. But I had been promoted as a manager. So going internally and saying, hey, I want to be an engineer again, saying, you haven't been a senior engineer. Can you do that job? Me saying, yeah, sure. Look, like it's leadership that grows the most from level 5 to level 6, not the tech. Of course, I'm ready. Not everyone bought that. And I can understand that. But it also meant then that I was going to look outside. In terms of how I got the job at Meta, over the years, I kept in touch with a lot of recruiters. Like when recruiters reached out, it wasn't ignore them. It wasn't like blow them off. It was like, I'm not looking right now, but I really appreciate the consideration. And if your situation changes and you can hire someone here in the Dallas area, please let me know. If my situation changes and I'm looking to move or I'm looking for a new role, I'll check in with you and see if we can work something out. So I already had the contacts. It was looking around. At the time I was looking, Google wasn't in the position to hire remotely yet. They hadn't made that call, and Meta had. So they were one of the few companies that I reached out to through my recruiting contacts. And then they said, hey, you've been managing for 3 years. That's enough for us for you to be this level of manager and M1. You can come do that, or you can interview for an E6 engineering role. They're at the same level internally, but which do you want to do? And I said, I want to get back to an engineering job. Prep for those interviews. Frankly, the reason it was easier for me to get ready for interviews after not having done it for 9 years or something was that at Amazon, I was a bar raiser and I interviewed a few hundred people from level 4 engineers to senior engineers and had loved that. And also had learned what makes for a good interview and how to talk your way through a coding interview instead of just going silent and asking questions and asking, hey, like this, the body of this method is obvious, right? So I'm just going to give the signature. And if we have time at the end, I'll come back to it. And you never come back to it. But once they give you that permission, you save time and can work on the meat of it. Went through the interview process, got an offer, negotiated it a little bit. I don't love negotiating, but I didn't know that when I joined Amazon, and they felt bad and were like, okay, we found some more money. So here's another $30,000 in stock, yeah, or something. And it was
some,
like,
some companies expect that. Amazon specifically, right, almost expects it. I think like I've friends over there, they've told me that whenever Amazon's working with partners, they never offer like the highest stakes. And similarly with when they hire people, they never offer the highest offer right away.
Sure. Yeah. Which I understand that I just didn't know that at the time. And I'm grateful that they gave me something. How much did I leave on the table? I don't know. I didn't care at the time. I was making $90,000 and then I was making $185,000. I didn't think I needed to make $212,000, but I maybe could have gotten that. I didn't know. But yeah, negotiated that Meta offer, started full remote. They were new at that. I was new at that. It was difficult. I didn't understand some of the processes. A lot of engineers are hired there unallocated, and then they go through a team match process after they've been hired. I think that's novel in a lot of ways. I think it's interesting in a lot of ways. it was very difficult for me. I wasn't used to that. Went through the boot camp, had to learn about their mono repo. That seemed like a crazy idea to me, and I had to adjust to it. I think it's an interesting thing now, but at the time I was like, can't do that. You can't keep everything in the same repository. Turns out you actually can. But I was very used to Amazon's Brazil build system and packages and version sets, and had banged my head against that enough that I had gotten used to it and could make it do what I wanted it to do, and had to start again. Along with that boot camp process, there was this team match process. And I don't know, but my feeling was that they were very good at matching the first few levels of engineers with teams. They knew what that looked like. They did it a lot. You'd come, you'd hang out for a week, and you'd code a couple of things, get a few commits in, and get a feel for the team, and then you're ready to join or not. It didn't make sense at my level. I couldn't understand how that was going to be the information that I would need to join a team. I've made two commits. What about the long-term strategy? What does this team need? Is this team lacking something that I can give it? Or am I going to be like, give you a lot of weight at the top, but not the benefit that you need? It just was all very hard for me to suss out. I went from 42 teams that had reached out to me because I clicked the box that said I knew Android. And that is a thing people like, and was an L6 internal person that knew Android. So everyone wanted me to go do that, and narrowed it down to 10 just reading the intros, and then talked to 10 managers and their most senior engineer or whatever to get a feel for it, and then narrowed it down to 3, then sat with them and did this coding and attended some meetings.
And this was already after you were hired. So this is after you're hired at like Facebook, you get hired as like a general SWE software engineer, and then they match you up to a team.
Yeah. Which again, I think is cool. Like saying you have to work on this insurance product or you can't come work here. Like that might not sell everyone, where it's up to you sounds really cool. I just really struggled with that process. And I struggled more when 2 of those 3 teams said, oops, like we can't hire an E6. And everyone was like, that's not possible. Like they can't do a reach out to someone if they don't have the rec and it's approved. I was like, it's cool to say that. 2 out of the 3 teams I had narrowed it down to did this. I don't know why. I don't know if it was bad luck, bad timing. Again, so then I was like, I didn't hate the remaining team, but it wouldn't have been my first choice. And I felt weird just accepting it because it was the only one that was still open to me. And ultimately, frankly, that division got shut down. So I'm fine with having made the decision not to join them. But then I felt adrift. I was like, am I doing that again? Am I starting with 40 teams again and going through all of this? And I made a call that I'll try it my way instead. And my way was use my internal network. I knew enough people from having already been in the industry for 15 years. And frankly, just having worked at Amazon, that was where pretty much all of my contacts had come from. Maybe one person was from one of the companies I worked at in Austin, but reached out and said, hey, tell me some senior plus engineers that you trust. Let me talk to them, see what they're building, or see if they know of any teams nearby that are building cool things. Find out if they have open recs, and then I'll talk to the managers. And so started that process, used my contacts, ultimately landed in the sort of commenting space for Android in the Blue app is what they call it, the Facebook app on Android. And a friend of mine that had managed a team in video when I was at Amazon was managing an adjacent team. And the person that was the director at the time had come from Amazon, even though I didn't know them. So I felt like I had my bearings. And then things went weird again. And a lot of that was on me not knowing how to tackle things and how to on board in this environment and as a very senior person, and identifying problems fast, but being too ready to try to jump in and solve them without having all the context or without knowing if that's what my job was at that time. Mm-hmm. And I found out too late, I think, that my job was start coding like you're an L3 and then code like an L4. And then do a small design and code more as an L5, and then step into L6 quality work. And they did tell me that, but they told me that after 6 weeks or something of already doing it wrong. And it was just challenging. And it's not all them. It's not all me. There was a lot of collusions of circumstances that led to this, but it was very difficult. And I didn't know how to proceed with that. I wanted to review code and review designs and fix morale and give people time to work on the things that really mattered by pushing down what we prioritized for the half. And that wasn't what they wanted me to do then. I think it needed to be done, but they needed me to ramp up, and I wasn't doing that in the right way. And I kept getting frustrated with tasks. I'd get a task and it didn't repro or only worked on this device or seemed very intractable. There weren't a lot of softball bugs to take on. It was a very complicated space. And so I was a little bit stymied, and ultimately, heading towards the end of that year, my manager had said, if you get this performance thing done by the end of the year, we can probably get you into the good rating, whatever the big middle rating was. If not, it's probably going to drop to the meets most rating, which is one step down. But that's not the end of the world. Like, people get that rating and really bounce back. And I think we can do that if you don't hit this goal. And so I was like, that's not great, but let me try it. Didn't get there, but I was like, yeah, well, I did my best on that, but it's okay. Start the new year strong. And then found out that manager left, and I rolled up to my skip level that it wasn't going to be meets most. It would be meet some, which is a death sentence. That's the bad one. You don't want that one. And so then it was like, now what? I can think this isn't fair, but that doesn't matter. I'm not going to.
And what you're talking about here are the performance reviews. Facebook calls it PSE, performance something cycle.
Sure.
Like all these companies have it. So, and I think there's 5 ratings, if I recall correctly, from my Facebook days. And this was like the lowest rating. Like, there's meets some, meets all, or meets some, meets most, meets all, exceeds, and whatever their euphemism is for that.
So then it was like, we don't really do the traditional performance plans for L6s because it's a hard, more intractable role and more complex. But if we could do that, we would be. And here's the HR rep that is going to oversee to make sure essentially that we fire you right and don't get into trouble. And the nail in the coffin, this was all very demoralizing, but the nail in the coffin was, even if you completely bounce back, this was maybe in January, February, even if you completely bounce back, ramp up, are contributing at an L6 level for most of the year, you're still not going to get more than meets most for the year. I was like, for the year? It's January. Like, how can we be making a call that I can't get to meets all for the year now? That seems bad. Like, that, it told me what I needed to know, which was like, you gave it a go and it didn't work out. And that was difficult. Like, I had made what I considered a very harrowing decision to leave Amazon, where I'd been for a long time and was well known and respected and knew how things worked and knew how to play the games and the politics and, you know, was good at it and helped people. And, you know, I was stepping out into this new challenge and then didn't rise to the level. And it was like, huh, that's disappointing. Should I go back to Amazon? Would I go back as an L6? How would that feel? Can I do that? But ultimately, as things were going bad, I was already reaching out. Google had made the decision to hire full remote. I also want to note, I never went to Seattle where that team was. That was a mistake. That was with Meta, yeah. I never met those people in person. Like, one person on my team's parents lived in the same city as Simon, and I met him for coffee one day, but I never went and sat with the team and got well integrated. And maybe that's not always necessary, but it would have been a good idea. And it didn't happen. And that's not what killed my chances there. It's just one more thing that I would change if I was doing it again, was go visit, be present. But yeah, I had reached out to a recruiting contact I had with Google again and had conversations. I'd done the FUBAR challenge, where if you Google a bizarre enough technical thing, then they're like, oh, if you're Googling that weird thing, you must be an engineer that we'd like to at least like probe. And I think some people have looked at particular phrases that'll trigger it, but I was legitimately just, oh, how do you do this obscure thing? And it was like, do you want to do this challenge? And I was like, yes, I do. I love to do challenges. This was not like, I'm going to get a job at Google. This was like, ooh, a coding challenge, and did that and got far enough to get a contact with a recruiter. But again, they were like, okay, do you want to work in Sunnyvale or Mountain View or Seattle? And I was like, Dallas? And they were like, no, not right now. So I was like, okay, if that changes. And by this time it had changed. So I reached out to the recruiter I knew, and she might have handled the whole thing. She might have handed me off to someone, but regardless, the point is having those relationships are the reason I was able to be mobile under duress. It was difficult. And if I hadn't had that and I was trying to go on a website and type something in, I would have been much worse, taken much longer, would have hurt my mental health and my confidence a lot more. That is a big thing for me, is like keeping those relationships. Same thing. I don't remember if they had asked if I wanted to interview as a people manager or not, but I didn't. I wanted to still stick with engineering. So went through the battery of interviews. I think that I didn't have to do a phone screen because of the FUBAR thing, even though it had been years before. Went right to the on-site, which was still all virtual at the time, but did that, had my email set up with an alert for my recruiter's emails, watching for whenever she would contact me. And it's a different process than I knew at Amazon. It's, we have a local committee, and then if they agree, then there's a central committee and we'll send it there, and then they'll see if they need any more data and they can approve an offer. And so it was a lot of, okay, got through this step, got through that step, but then ultimately got to the offer stage, another pretty brief negotiation, and then accepted that offer. There was some lag in the team match because Google was doing that in advance, unlike Meta that did that once you were onboarded. Talked to a few different directors about their space, or one was a senior manager, and ultimately joined the chat org working on what we call spaces, which is just the lots of people in a room talking as part of the chat product. So that's the story so far, minus like my time at Google, but that's how I made my way through the industry, from small companies to medium-sized company to three of the largest companies. So
yeah, cool. And I really appreciate your transparency and authenticity with your autism. So right on your LinkedIn profile, you introduce yourself as staff software engineer at Google, good person to know, which I would attest to that, autistic, and then your Substack channel. But talk about the autism. When were you diagnosed with it? When were you comfortable sharing that in your career? Was it, and how has that impacted your career? The fact that you're not just diagnosed with it, but you're also comfortable with the diagnosis as much to put it right on your LinkedIn profile.
Yeah, most of my life, I did not know. I'm fun now. I think I'm forgetting now if it was 2 years ago. I think it was about 2.5 years ago that I had an evaluation done and got an official diagnosis. And the diagnosis they use is autism spectrum disorder. Asperger's isn't a thing anymore. They treat in the DSM, if people want to identify that way themselves, more power to
DSM
them.
DSM is a diagnostic statistical manual for psychology.
Sure. So that sort of says like, what do we got? What are the conditions? And as we learn more, it might say, you know what, we're not going to treat this as a separate diagnosis because it's actually just part of this other thing. So anyway, got that diagnosis then when I was 39-ish. So had spent a long time being just weird or eccentric, or just, I didn't know. I knew I was different. Sometimes I knew I was different in certain ways, but a lot of times with anything that's psychological, we don't always know. We're having some different experience than other people because we can never experience thought as another person. So there would be things where it's just, oh, I guess I just don't try hard enough to understand people's body language. If I just committed myself and really tried, maybe I could do it, but I don't know. I guess I'm just not good enough at that, or don't try hard enough. And it's, oh no, you can't do that. It's just, you'll have to figure out a different way because your brain just doesn't do that. And it's, oh, other people either it's pretty easy or completely intuitive for them to read that. And for me, it's like nearly impossible. Okay, that's good to know. That's helpful to understand that it's not some weakness of mine or a lack of interest or trying or whatever, that this my brain works differently. And I treat autism and ADHD, I was also diagnosed with as a child, but I treat these things as differences. Disorder is in the name. That's fine. That's what doctors have in there. I really consider it a trade. There's a lot of things that I struggle with or have greater challenges with than other people. And then there's things that it grants me, that the attention to detail that I have, the pattern recognition that I have, the sort of like ability to think about problems in a different way than a lot of people might, has been dramatically beneficial to me in my life generally, in academics and in my career, especially working in a job where software engineers, the thing that people think of is, oh, you write code. And it's like, yeah, we solve problems. And sometimes it's with code. It's not always. Being able to solve problems or think about problems in a different way, and being able to look at someone else's design and be like, I've had to learn how to do so in a presentable way, because before I didn't know that facts could hurt people's feelings. It was like, oh, that won't work. Just fix that. And it's, that actually is not something people can always hear. Even if I'm right, it needs to be presentable in a way that people can hear it and respond to it and synthesize that. I had to switch my mode of operation to asking more questions and making fewer assertions. That's wrong. Might be true. Like, it may factually be incorrect or an untenable approach, but it also isn't connecting to a person. And if you're not connecting to people, you will not succeed. So being able to say, oh, you know what? Like the last time that I tried to do something like this, where it was a distributed problem, keeping a distributed counter like this was actually really hard. It might, have you thought about other solutions, or have you like looked into GUIDs for this, or having a partially correct counter, but we don't rely on that for correctness? Have you thought about any other things? Because I just really suffered and it really delayed the project the last time I tried to do something like this. It's just a very different thing that saying, I'm leaning on my experience to tell you that I suffered and I'm trying to save you suffering, is very different than you are wrong and you need to fix it. But that took time and feedback that I had to get to figure that out, because a manager said, you know what, you're right a lot. And people don't want to listen to you when you tell them that, like, this bluntly. And it was like, oh, that makes sense. I can see how that could be a hurtful thing. Let me try to redo that. And essentially, this is how it works for a lot of things in my life. And I think it's a somewhat standard autism thing is, if I can have rules, I can follow them. So if the rule is, don't assert someone is wrong, okay, or at least in a professional setting with your children, maybe that's okay. But like, your peers aren't your children. Don't do that. I can stick to that rule. Otherwise, in terms of my professional life, a lot of it has been the social side and the soft skills. And something that I did learn fairly early, maybe not by the time I'd gotten to Amazon, but pretty soon after, was that the relationships and people is all there is. It's the whole job. So I had to figure out how to better foster these relationships and maintain them, and had to figure out some of the social things that might be different in a professional setting than in personal settings. And that, I think one of the hardest was that sometimes people mean you ill will and intent. And that was unfathomable to me. Why would you do that? Aren't we working to make the company money or serve these customers in the best way possible? Like, why would you try to sabotage something I'm doing? Or why would you tell someone untrue about me? And coming to the realization that I can't stop that from happening, but there are people with those motivations. And it may be, you know, just sport for them. It may be trying to usurp your position as a lead or to you know, get a promotion by making you look worse. And okay, even if I'm not going to play that game, I need to be aware that is real and exists. How am I going to incorporate that into my worldview? How can I bridge to people who are very difficult to work with? Them being difficult, I can't just say, no, that person's difficult to work with, so we can't partner with them on this project. Like, that doesn't work. So then what? Like, mm-hmm. How do you smooth conflicts? I'm super conflict averse. I've gotten better at it, but I don't like fighting. I don't like yelling. I don't like any of that. Again, part of that is probably a trauma response, and that's a little sad. But on the other hand, I'm a very good negotiator, even as a third party and not being involved myself. I can be like, okay, here's where you're coming from. Here's where they're coming from. We're missing something. What is the missing piece? Because we want to solve the same problem. Why do you think their idea is going to be like the end of the world? Why do you think their idea is going to actively harm users? How can we reconcile these things? What is the difference? And if we can't bottom that out right now, is there one thing that we can agree on so we can start working and figure the rest of this out as we go? And being able to like calm things down, slow them down, stop a like cycle of battling and move toward what's actionable. You being mad isn't actionable, but we need to have a contract agreed upon between these two systems. Is if we're persisting something this way or that way, does that affect this contract? No, then let's get that spec'd, and then we will get some other input or do some more research or prototype and figure out the storage later.
Yeah, cool, Lee. This has been a really engaging conversation and the time just flew by. So I do want to cover, like, I do want to dig deeper into some of these, and it might have to be in a part two episode. Sure. Here. But I do want to ask you two final questions here.
Sure.
Throughout your career, very successful career, working at some of the best tech companies in the world, and I know you coach and mentor lots of individuals. What's your favorite piece of career advice that you give people? Leave our listeners here with some sick career advice that you want to leave them with.
Sure. Yeah, I think that I've heard it stated about, say, interpersonal relationships or romantic relationships. Do you want to be right or do you want to be close? I think that this applies a lot in the professional world as well, mm-hmm. and is one of the more important things. Is it important to me to dominate and ensure that I win this meeting? Or does it turn out that you can't win and all that can happen is you make the best decision or you make a selfish decision? And so choosing to actually step back and not treat your idea as your baby or your decision or your system or whatever you've done, and do what's best for users, customers, coworkers, even if it's not your idea, or compromising on what you think is the best idea so that you can maintain relationships that are going to be key to doing the right things in the future, do that. Being sure of your ideas and sacrificing relationships to keep them at the forefront is super dangerous. And when we work in coding, we think oftentimes very yes or no. There's a right answer and a wrong answer. And when you tell the machine to do something, it does it. And there's a right way and a wrong way. Mm-hmm. And if you carry that over to interpersonal decision-making and relationships, it's super dangerous and caustic.
Yeah, there's a lot more gray when you get outside of coding. And then the last question, Lee, where can people follow you? Where can people reach out to you? I'm pretty sure I know where the answer is here.
Sure.
But yeah. Just for those that do not follow you as closely as me.
Yeah. I post most on LinkedIn. It is a good way to be able to reach out to me. It has a connect button. Please, if someone wants to connect or follow me, send a message. Like, I can't accept every connection. That's just completely without any context, but it's Lee McKeeman is my name. I could spell it, but you'll probably just look at this podcast episode. Yeah. So I'll just rely on that. And similarly, I've started writing on Substack. A lot of the content is aggregated because LinkedIn is a little bit wonky and you might not see all of someone's content. So I aggregate it on Substack so people can find it all. And I've been doing a read through and reflection on the book Staff Engineer. So that I'm putting specifically on Substack because it's just too long for LinkedIn. That's the best place to find me, follow me, contact me. So yeah, look forward to hearing from anyone interested in connecting.
Awesome, Lee. It's been great getting to know you on LinkedIn and off of LinkedIn. And thank you for all the insights here. We didn't even get to go into your Google career yet.
It's true.
But we'll have to do a part two here on the podcast. But thank you so much for joining us. Absolutely. Thanks for inspiring folks on LinkedIn. And thanks for sharing your story so transparently and authentically. So I appreciate you.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks a lot, Lee.